All right, good morning, everybody. I want to welcome everybody, those who were here last night. Welcome again, those who weren't. Good morning to all. It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Shmuel Klitzner, who we had the pleasure of hearing over Shabbat in the Or Chaim area. And Rabbi Klitzner has been teaching at Bravender's in Yerushalayim for over 20 years. He made Aliyah. Midrashet Lindenbaum. I stand corrected. Okay. All right. We'll start again. Rabbi Klitzner has been teaching in Midrashet Lindenbaum since 1987, making Aliyah in 1977. He told me actually he's the founder, one of the founders of CAT, Chevra Aliyah Tornit, which is interesting because I was very involved in the first minyan they started in Flatbush when I finished, you know, YU. But he's been living in Israel a long time. He is now very involved, actually, he alluded to it last night. He's involved in they started a school in Modi'im, basically for children of parents who used to be observant, who no longer are observant, did not feel comfortable in the Chiloni system, wanted to give their kids a Jewish education, but they themselves are not Orthodox. It's interesting in that. He's the author of this book, Wrestling Jacob, which he spoke about a little yesterday and today. They are on sale afterwards, and it's really a pleasure to have him, and I will let him get started with his talk right now. Okay, thank you very much.
Boker Tov, everyone. I'd like to get started right away because I understand we're under very tight time constraints. And as I said when I spoke in Or Chaim on Shabbat, I feel somewhat less guilty about what we call in Israel pega ubrach, hit and run, when there's no continuity, at least at this point. If somebody wants to get a hold of my book, because what I'm going to speak about is in the book as well, a much more expanded version than what we can do in a half hour, 40 minutes, I feel less guilty about being able to give only part of it and not say the entire theory. There are chumashim here, and it would be good if at least at every table there be one or two chumashim, so you can follow along and not trust me, but check to see if we're doing indeed a close reading of the text. This is not going to be a lecture; it's going to be a class, a shiur. But I'd like to say a couple of words at the outset about methodology. On the one hand, this book is a book about Yaakov. It's a book about the Jacob stories in Bereshit and Genesis. It's a book about wrestling with oneself. It's about deception. It's about identity. It's about children trying to receive the blessings of the parents, parents trying to bless their children. And the difficulty in receiving a blessing and feeling entitled to a blessing if you receive the blessing as someone else or as part of a circumvention or a self-deception. If you are blessed as someone else, you are not really truly blessed, or you can never really, really truly feel entitled to the blessing. And I think that the stories of Yaakov are really stories about all of us, Yaakov as every man. And every woman in that sense. And I want to say a couple more words about methodology before we begin doing a close reading of what I think is the fantastic climax of the story of Yaakov, the famous scene of wrestling, the wrestling scene itself. I want to say two things. There is in biblical exegesis, in biblical interpretation, the stuff that exegesis is made of is textual difficulty. When you see a word that is an anomaly, that it seems to be the wrong word to be used in the text, or you see an ungrammaticality, or you see jumbled syntax, you see something that doesn't fit the predominant style of biblical writing, that is the stuff of which great exegesis is made. Now, one school of thought, the historical critical school of thought, will take wrong wording or difficulties in the text and often will try to say they are indeed wrong. It's the wrong word, and if you got a better manuscript or if you could, through conjecture, reach an original reading of what it said, you might be able to get the right word. The medieval classical religious exegetes, Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and Rashbam, and others, often try to explain why what seems to you to be the wrong word is really the right word. And I wanted to take a third approach. I think this third approach has ample anchor in the Midrash and in various other biblical exegesis going back through the centuries, but is not the predominant way of looking at things, I think, in the Middle Ages. And that is to say that the wrong word may indeed be the wrong word, and it is used purposefully as the wrong word. And it is there to point from the text to a subtext. And the subtext often is a subtext which reflects the unconscious or the subconscious or the motivation of the characters in the stories. My thesis methodologically in terms of why I call it deception, identity, and Freudian slips in Genesis is that if you mine that wrong wording, if you both mind it and mine it, you will wind up with a relationship which says somewhat along the following lines, that text is to subtext as conscious is to subconscious or to unconscious. And I want to say one more methodological preliminary remark, and then we'll go straight into a reading. I want to say something about repetition. There's a part of my introduction to my book that's called Repetition, Repetition, Repetition. And it is about the artful use of repetition in Tanakh, in many of the narrative sections of Tanakh. And I want to give a little nuance on what has been said in prior times. Many people have noticed that so many things get repeated. And, of course, again, the historical critical school will do what they do with it. The literary school will often point to repetition of a theme or repetition of a situation as indicative of a musical symphonic structure in which first we have to recognize a theme, and then when there are variations on the theme, you can understand the theme in greater depth because you've established a pattern. And then when the pattern deviates and the octaves go in different directions, you get a more nuanced reading of the text. There is yet another interpretation of the purposeful repetition that often occurs, which is very well known to all of us. It's called poetic justice, or midah keneged midah, the measure for measure, and it's very saturated through the Jacob stories. Things that Jacob does, switching himself for the older brother, then get happened to him when Rachel is switched for Leah, and we're all very familiar to this. I want to suggest a fourth and a fifth type of repetition that I believe occur at least in these stories, and I think I've noticed it in other narratives as well, and I'm in the process of developing the following idea. Psychologists and psychotherapists talk about repetition as behavior that individuals arrange or work about and bring about through various neuroses or compulsions. If something isn't worked through, I unconsciously invite the same situation to occur again in order to see if I can this time get it right. That's on a totally unconscious level. And those of you who are not psychotherapists or social workers or psychologists or have not done a reading, and I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and I'm just an avid reader in what fascinates me, you can just ask yourself the following question. How many times have you heard yourself or someone close to you start a sentence with the words, "I don't know why I always," or "I don't know why I always seem to get up late on a you know, when I want to get to davening on time. It could be any one of a number of things. Whenever I meet my mother-in-law, I tend to all sorts of things that are we consider the reason why we don't know why is because the constrictions on our autonomous conscious behavior are exactly that. We are unconscious of them. They belong to the realm of the repressed or the unconscious. And so I think that we might witness in the Yaakov stories, we definitely will witness, an unconscious repetition of the situations that keep occurring. Just to give you the example that's most clear, if he begins by usurping his brother by an unfair, what seems to be an unfair barter of broth for birthright, of the nizida dashim, the lentil soup for the bechara, it happens, and my claim in the class that I gave on Shabbat and Or Chaim is that the nizida dashim is a replacement for his brother's tzayid, for the venison. There is subterfuge going on, and it gets pumped up exponentially when he actually impersonates his brother, and in order to get the blessing, is willing to say, Anochi Esav b'charecha. I am Esav, which is an act of almost what psychologists might call dissociation. I am not me. And this subterfuge, in order to get the blessing, occurs again in the famous incident of the speckled, spotted, striped sheep, where one of them is called Akudim, by the way. He wants to get the Akudim, which sounds like the Akud, which would be a description of that, of Yitzchak, of Jacob's father, who was the Akud, who was the who was bound to the altar in the famous binding of Isaac story. And situations repeat themselves. At the end of that speckled, spotted, striped sheep episode, his brothers-in-law look at him and say, Lakach Yaakov et kol asher la'avinu. Jacob took all that belonged to our father, and the result is that Jacob must flee his father-in-law's house, which of course reminds us of his brother having claimed the same thing. He's taken everything that belonged to me, and having to flee his father's house. And things repeat themselves, and I'm leading up to what I think is a fifth type of repetition. And here I'm going out on a limb, but I want to suggest that sometimes, and the way psychotherapy in the classic, at least not just in the Freudian model, but the way psychotherapy posits things, you sometimes repeat something in a controlled environment with a therapist. And the therapist is mostly, and sometimes maddeningly, a mirror for your own musings, right? A good therapist is that's maddening. Also, if you all see these movies where this fellow is terrible angst, terrible anxiety, and he says something that should elicit an equal response, and in some schools of therapy, the psychologist says, well, how do you feel about that? But there is a purpose to that school of orchestrating the therapeutic moment, in which the situation that is really plaguing you, and that you may have forgotten or repressed, right, is brought to the fore in a controlled way. It's sometimes referred to as transference, and in that therapeutic setting, there is the possibility of a cathartic breakthrough, of a cathartic moment where the unconscious knocks on the cellar door, those things that we've relegated from the living room of our souls to the basement of the soul. There are these knocks on the door, sometimes through Freudian slips when we use the wrong language, sometimes through the language of the unconscious, which is the dream, and Yaakov has a dream that I've analyzed in my book as well in a particular way. And sometimes through the artful use of repetition, not as midah keneged midah, poetic justice, not as simply a literary device, but and not simply as an inner compulsion, but also repetition in order to create the moment that may be an enabling moment. It may be an injurious moment, but it is an enabling moment. And that is particularly where we're going to enter the text. If you have a chumash near you, And you can open it up to chapter 32 in Bereshit, in Genesis. I want to pick it up. I must, because time is so short, and I want to leave some time for questions and comments, I'm going to take a shortcut and tell you that the key words that reoccur again and again, particularly in chapter 31, leading up to the scene of Jacob wrestling with the mysterious man. I don't call him an angel because the text doesn't call him an angel. He's called an Ish, a man, but he's clearly something of the human, something of the divine. And leading up to that, there are several words that keep recurring. The word gneva, or ligzol, but mostly gneva, lignov, is on Yaakov's lips all the time. In fact, sometimes in very inappropriate ways. One of the great Freudian slips, sort of, is when he's defending himself the night before this episode to his father-in-law and uncle Lavan, who has chased after him and basically said, what do you mean taking autonomous action? You belong to me. When he chases after him and eventually catches up to him and he's defending himself in a speech which is a speech of self-defense, he uses the language of self-incrimination. One verse that comes to mind is that he says, I never brought you sheep, as tending your flocks all those years, I never brought you sheep that had been slain. Trefa lo heveti lecha. And if I did ever bring you a dead sheep, a sheep that was torn by beasts, then miyadita bakshena, you asked for repayment. Anochi achatena, miyadita bakshena, genufti yom, genufti laila. And exegetes are wondering what the word achatena has the root I have sinned, or to sin, lachto. Used anomalously. It's the wrong word to use. It's used to mean to bear recompense, to pay back. But it's the only place in all of the Bible where that root is used in that way. And then the verse continues, and he says, instead of saying, in my guarding of your sheep from being stolen, he says, in effect, in my stealing by day and in my stealing by night, genufti yom, genufti laila. It's an anomalous form of that verb. There are many. He says, Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad esav. Protect me. He's about to meet up. You know that this episode is between two fateful encounters. The night before he had met, or the day before he had met with Lavan. The next day he's going to meet up with his brother Esav, who he hasn't seen in decades, and the last time they were together, he had threatened to kill him. He's now approaching with 400 men, a veritable army, and so we're at a crucial moment in time, and he prayed to God the night before, and he said, protect me from my brother from the hands of Esav, and even the words Yidei Esav, right, take us back to the deception scene, where Jacob had said, right? Hakol kol Yaakov v'hayadayim yedei Esav. The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esav. And he says, protect me from the hands of Esav. Pen yavo v'hikani b'eim al banim, lest he come and smite me. And then there's an interesting phrase also that creeps into his language of mother over sons. And if we recall the deception scene, that's precisely, or mother in addition to sons in the vernacular, but all sorts of language that brings up the sense of guilt. This interpretation, by the way, has been anticipated by the 19th century author of the Ktava Kabbalah, who suggested that when at the very beginning he said, perhaps my father will touch me and he'll know that I'm smooth-skinned and my brother is hairy and I'll bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing, the wrong word is used. He should have said, pen yimusheni avi. There's two ways to say maybe something will happen in biblical Hebrew. You can say something lest it happen. It might happen, and I don't want it to happen. And you can use the word ulai. Perhaps it will happen. And ulai is almost always used in the context of something you want to happen. So does he want to be discovered? Well, on the level of subtext and subconscious, there is a classic Freudian slip here. But it is, I've only mentioned a couple of the instances, but we have ample indication that Yaakov is plagued by a deception, an attempt to be blessed by and loved by his father. In ways that involve circumvention and deception and subterfuge, and the paradox of trying to receive a blessing again as someone else is that I can never really feel entitled, and so the entire text is again, I believe, saturated with this deep-seated lack of. He says to Lavan, he says, "Tana et nashai, give me my wives." Now, if they're your wives, no one has to give them to you. But he doesn't feel that his life belongs to him. It's mortgaged to Lavan. And Lavan understands this. And he says to him, Habanot benotai, vahabanim banai, vatson soni, the children are mine, the daughters are mine, the flocks are mine, b'chol asher ata ro'er, all that you see, lihu, it belongs to me. He's used covenantal language here. B'chol asher ata ro'er, all of that which you see was the original covenantal language to Abraham. Lecha et nena, everything you see will be given to you. But in trying to get the blessing of Abraham, he sent that covenantal destiny into a tailspin. What I want to suggest is, and you'll have to trust me here because we don't have time to go into chapter 31 in detail, but in chapter 31 he uses the word again and again. The text uses the word lignov, 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 to steal, to steal, to steal. There are two verses in which all three of our the other phrases are lo lahagid, not telling, and livroach, and to evade. And these are in fact the modus operandi. This is the mode of negotiating life that Yaakov, and his very name Yaakov, means to circumvent. It means to come from behind, to grab the heel. In fact, Esav uses that way. Vayatveni ze pa'amayim. He has Jacobed me twice, held me back, usurped me twice. It's used that way in Jeremiah, in Yirmiyahu Perektet. If you want, Jeremiah wants to talk about deceitfulness, so he says, "Kol ach Akov Yaakov." Right? Every brother is deceitful. Right? But in the words for being deceitful are every brother Jacob Jacobs. And Akov Yaakov, and we're about to see a text that is so rampant with wordplay. And I suggest in the introduction of my book that wordplay is a very serious matter in Tanakh. We call it play, but it's not at all to be taken lightly. Those three terms, lo lahagid, not to tell, livroach, to evade, to escape, to flee, and lignov, to steal, are used, in fact, in confluence, all three of them, in two separate verses in chapter 31. Vayignov Yaakov et lev Lavan ha'arami, al bli higid lo ki boreachu. Jacob stole the heart of Lavan the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. Lavan uses the same three terms a few verses later. Lama nachbeta livroach, why have you concealed your fleeing? You have stolen me, vatignov oti, velohi gadetali, and you haven't told me. And I had emailed in advance, but there are such wonderful organizers here, I can't blame anybody. I wish I had a blackboard here or a whiteboard, but if I did, I would show you that there's so many words that are at play with one another, including the word lahagid, to tell, which is at play with the gidi, the goat, which was the instrument of deception that when Rebecca gave Jacob the skins of the goats and the goats to disguise as venison in order to get the blessing from the father. Gidi is at play with lahagid. And I think in a moment I'll tell you it's at play with the word gid, which is the sinew of the thigh, which is going to come up in this section. And bracha is at play with bechorah, and machaneh is at play with mincha, and Yaakov is at play with yabok and vayavek. And I want to suggest the following. Before we do this last little piece of reading, I owe credit to my students. I teach at a wonderful institution in Jerusalem called Midreshet Lindenbaum, or Bravender or Bruria. And about 16 years ago, two students were learning in Chevruta, preparing for my shiur, and they came up to me and they said, could it be coincidence that in one verse in chapter 32, the Jacob says to the, after the wrestling match has been resolved in some very tenuous resolution, he says, Hagida na shemecha, pray tell me your name. Hagida, listen to the phonetics. Hagida na shemecha. And two verses later, the socket of the thigh, the kafyerech, that has been strained or sprained or dislocated, is referred to as the gid hanashe, as the sinew of the thigh or the sciatic nerve. It's been translated various different ways, but it loses everything in the translation. Because there's clearly also a play, not only between gid and gidi, between the goat and the and lahagid, to tell, but also between telling, lahagid, and the gid hanashe, the sinew of the thigh, which is the place of his injury, the injury that enables. So without any further ado, let's take a look. We're going to pick up the text from chapter 32, verse 25. Lamed bet kafe. Vayivater Yaakov levado. Vayavek ish imo ad alot hashachar. And much ink has been spilt on the question of who is it who is wrestling with Yaakov. He is alone, and yet he is wrestling with someone. Now, unless those are sequential statements, it doesn't say someone accosted him. So it is a reasonable, even on a pshat level, on a simple reading, that he is wrestling with himself. That is the possibility of someone being alone and yet wrestling with someone. Supporting this, by the way, is something that I noticed a while ago. The term levado, alone, together with the root, the Hebrew root, tzadi lamed ayin, okay, appears elsewhere in Tanakh. Tzela, yafeh. When it's in chapter 2 of Bereishit, we are told, lo tov heyot adam levado, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make a helpmeet against him, opposite him. And then the man is put to sleep, the anesthesiologist, God as anesthesiologist, brings upon him slumber. And woman is built from his tzela, which is sometimes translated rib, and more often in Tanakh it means aside. And therefore the word, etymologically, the word to limp, or to favor one side, is tzolea, which is what is about to be described a few verses on. Jacob is first levado, and afterwards emerges tzolea. And I would suggest to you that what we have here is some intertextual allusion to another episode in which a man, in order to become more whole, in that case through the creation of woman, is split in half. That is probably or at least a very possible interpretation of what happened when he was put under in chapter 2, in order for the woman to be brought back to him and for him to become more whole than he was before he was bifurcated. There might even be some play on words between vayivater and vayivater with a bet, even though I know that a good Yemenite would pronounce it vayivater, vayivater. Yaakov is alone, and someone is wrestling with him until Alot Hashachar, until the dawn. We move on. Vayar ki lo yacholo, vayigab b'chaf yirecho, vateka kaf yerech Yaakov behavko imo. The mysterious accosting presence sees that he cannot overcome Yaakov. And so he hits him below the belt. He hits him in the back of the thigh, which is, again, a repetition sort of someone else coming from behind and grabbing the heel of his brother. Right? It has that resonance, that repetition possibility. Vayomer shalcheni ki ala hashachar. And this is a fantastic, I want to give my own interpretation here, but I think it is part of a literary pshat and I wouldn't relegate it easily to drash or remez or sod. I would call it a plain reading. The angel who has accosted him says, I must go because the dawn is about to rise. And whenever I ask students in a classroom what type of nighttime creature needs to fear the dawn, I always get the answer, a vampire, yes. And, okay, now that we've said it, I want to move from science fiction back into literary analysis. I want to suggest that if he is indeed wrestling with himself, the alter ego, the dark side, the shadow side, the side that has been relegated and repressed into lo lahagid, not telling, livroach, to flee, to evade, that forgotten side cannot tolerate, cannot risk enlightenment, cannot risk. That is very frightening. It threatens on an unconscious level, not on a conscious level, on an unconscious level, it threatens the wholeness, the fragile wholeness that's been achieved only at the cost of subterfuge and deception, mostly self-deception. But to have that moment is so often, I would imagine, therapists have the patient on the brink of some self-awareness, only to have it shut down by the need to preserve whatever repressions, suppressions, shadowy dark side needs to reside in the nighttime, in the dark. And the light, Alot HaShachar, is very threatening. And yet this is the moment, this between, in the middle of verse 27. In the middle of verse 27, Vayomer Shalcheni ki Alah HaShachar, this mirror self says, send me forth for the dawn is breaking. And surprisingly, it doesn't make any sense on the level of plot development. Jacob, who had been accosted to begin with, should have been more than happy to send him away. He's also remembered that he's been injured already. And yet he says, Lo ashalechacha ki im berachtani. I cannot send you, I cannot release you because I need the blessing. And Rashi comments, it doesn't say in the future tense, ki'im tivarcheni, it says ki'im berachtani, because I need the blessing. It's almost as if he's saying, I need not your blessing now, I need the validation of the blessing that I got or that I tried to receive by means of deception. Now, this is a moment, I call it, it's a heroic moment. It's the moment in which he says, I am not going to act according to those three basic factors in my identity, in my name, Yaakov, to circumvent. I am not going to lo lahagid, not to tell. I am not going to be gone, I'm not going to be boreach. I'm going to wrestle with you. And I'm going to wrestle with you at the risk of injury, which he's already incurred at some level, and at the risk of daylight. And he says, Lo ashalechacha ki'im berachtani, I need the bracha. Now, why is it that this is, it's very clear why this is the moment of breakthrough. Why can he no longer evade his past? Well, his past is waiting for him in the next few hours when literally his past will catch up with him and Esav, his long-lost brother, from whom he stole the birthright or the blessing, is going to face him. So he now has no choice. He's in that moment, in that unique moment of injury and yet enablement. And notice what happens. And here I call it, he is fortunate, Yaakov, because he has the perfect therapist. The mirror self says, you want the blessing? Vayomer elav ma shemecha. What is your name? The last time he wanted a blessing, someone also asked him, what is your name? And that time he answered, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. I am Esav. And now he says, Vayomer Yaakov. And paradoxically, and now I think it makes sense, he says, now that he says, I am Yaakov, the next verse says, Vayomer lo Yaakov yomer od shimcha ki im Yisrael, ki sarita im Elokim v'im anashim v'tuchal. Paradoxically, but we know this to be a psychological truth, only when you are who you are and have ceased to relegates to the darkness or to the forgetfulness or to the realm of the shadows who you are, can you evolve into the next stage? Can you become Yisrael? And Yisrael is in two ways the opposite of Yaakov. It bears the words Yashar, V'haya ha'akov l'mishor, right? It is, as opposed to Yaakov, which means to go in the crooked way, it means to go straight. And it means to struggle, Kisarita, because you've struggled with men and with God. And I have a quarrel here only with the translation of the word Vatuchal. Most translators understand it to mean, and you have prevailed, similar to the previous verse, Vayar ki lo yachol lo, where yachol lo meant he saw that the angel saw that he couldn't prevail against him, and he struck him behind on the thigh. But here it doesn't say Vatuchal lahem, it just says Vatuchal. And I want to suggest that the better translation, rather than you emerged victorious or you prevailed, but you've become enabled, Vatuchal. And that is, in fact, more true to the therapeutic moment. The therapeutic moment is not a moment in which you have conquered some territory, never to be conquered again. Therapists write of the therapeutic moment being a moment of breakthrough, of catharsis, of enablement, and yet the struggle continues, as indeed his struggle does continue. And he is the only one of the avot, you'll recall, who doesn't have his name changed from Avram to Avraham or Sarai to Sarai, and it never goes back to the previous name. His name will continue to be called Yaakov alternatively with the name Yisrael, because he is both. I had a student, a wonderful Israeli student at Lindenbaum. We have about 100 Israeli students and 100 students from Chutz La'aretz. And one of the students said, you know, I want to confirm your thesis in chapter 35. If you can look there, there is another scene of the name change. Here his name change is given by the mysterious wrestler. Later on in Beit El, his name is changed again, but this time by God. And if you look at it there, it's a very strange phrasing. God says to him, Shimcha Yaakov, lo yikare Shimcha Yaakov ki Yisrael. It says, your name is Jacob. Your name will no longer be called Jacob, it will be called Israel. But first, your name is Yaakov. That is the sine qua non. That is the prerequisite for the development or the enablement, the evolution towards Yisrael. It's also interesting that the place is called Beit El, but we have prior foreshadowing at the beginning of Parashat Vayetze, where he was originally at Beit El, and he dreamt the dream with the ladder going up and down, connecting his inner worlds, perhaps. It's upstairs, his downstairs, his attic, his cellar. There it takes trouble to say that Beit El was formerly called Luz. Okay, the Ulam Luz Shem Ha'ir LaRishonah. Again, foreshadowing that even when we get a new name, the old name must remain with us. It must be there. The new name can't be achieved at the cost of denial of the old name. In fact, the name Luz in Mishle and other places, the root of it means to deceive, deception, deviousness. And in fact, one of the sticks, the rods that he uses to manipulate the sheep and the speckled and spotted sheep is a makel luz vilivne. That phrase keeps appearing. There's so much wonderful wordplay that you can't really begin to study this in translation. But I want to continue on in the text. The text has a wonderful postscript. Vayishal Yaakov vayomer. Hagida na Shemach, we're up to verse 30, chapter 32, verse 30. Vayish'al Yaakov vayomer, Hagida na Shemecha. He says now to the angel, he reverses, he says, tell me your name. Vayomer lama zeh tish'al lishmi. Vayavarech oto sham. And I understand this to mean, why do you have to ask my name? This is, by the way, this is always in the scene later on in Tanakh of Manoach and Eshet Manoach. It's not a good question to ask an angel or a mysterious man what his name is. This is deemed a silly question to ask. Only people who don't understand the essence of an angelic appearance will ask this question. But I take it on another level to mean, you know perfectly well who I am. And he blessed him there. Vayavarech oto sham. And then, Vayikra Yaakov shema makom pni'el ki ra'iti Elohim panim el panim vati natzel nafshi. Vayizrach lo hashemesh kasher avaret pnuel v'hut soleya al yirecho. And here you have soleya, which we talked about earlier. It's soleya, to limp. The place is called panim el panim, pniel, pnuel. Because he has now changed his mode of existence from coming from behind, from achora, achare, 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 from behind, 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 which was the key word leading up to this chapter. And im lavan garti va'echar ad ata, he is the latecomer, he is the ma'acher, he comes from behind and he's called the latecomer. And now he is negotiating panim el panim, face to face. This is again the change of the enabling is to not to evade, not to repress, not to tell, but to come face to face, to cope. And that is enabling. And at the same time, he is tzolei yichud because it is an injury that enables. And I often think that one really can't have the enablement without the injury. And we should often look at the injury as an enabling moment. If we had more time, I would develop it. But I want to move on to the next phrase. Al-Kain, we're on verse 33. Al-Kain lo yochlu v'nei Yisrael et gid ha-nasheh asher al-kaf ha-yarech ad ha-yom hazeh, ki naga b'chaf yarech Yaakov b'gid ha-nasheh. And so this is now clearly a symbolic postscript, because it extends not just to this story, but forever after, Jews will remove that sinew when they want to kosher their meat and eat kosher meat. And the sinew that Bnei Yisrael, that Israelites will remove, is called after the place of his injury, which is called the Gid HaNasheh. And we talked a little bit before about the play between Gid and Lahagid, Gid HaNasheh, Hagid HaNashemecha. I want to suggest that the Gid is the telling. And what is nasheh? It's a very unusual word. It's unique in its lexical form here. But the closest we come to the word nasheh, and Rashi sends us in that direction, is the name that the son of Yaakov gives to his own son, Menasheh. And Menasheh is called Menasheh because? Ki nashani? Because God caused me to forget, or helped me forget, my father's house and my tribulations. Now that is in itself a fantastic paradox. I mean, you call your son, he wants to forget this, himself being sold into slavery by his brothers. He wants to forget the tribulations of his father's house, and he is now risen to second in command in the entire land of Egypt, and he calls his son, forget my father's house. Can you imagine? Could you come here, please, and help me with this with this heavy suitcase? I have my son here, who's been my nosekel. Can you come help me forget my father's house? It is the equivalent, I suggest in my book, of an Eastern European immigrant coming to the States and naming his firstborn son Repressala. You know, but herein is the rub. Because this paradox is inherent in the very concept of repression. What do we do when we repress something from or forget something? To cause to forget is to repress. When we repress something from the conscious to the unconscious, we've in fact preserved it. The only way to put something in the past is to work it through. If it is unworked through, it remains there and will haunt us in ways that constrict our autonomy. Going back to what we talked about at the beginning, I don't know why I always, okay? The very definition, the wonderful psychotherapist named David Shapiro of the New School for Social Research, who defines neurosis as the constriction of autonomy. It is that which I am unaware of that constricts my autonomy. And so in this enabling moment, in this autonomy-giving moment, he is struck, he is injured, it is an injury that enables, and the injury is referred to as the Gid HaNasheh, or I suggest the telling of the repressed. That is the wordplay. L'Hagid et HaNashui, or L'Hagid HaNasheh, the words, especially at play with Hagid HaNashemecha, please tell me your name, he needs literally to say his name, Yaakov, and to own up to his own modus vivendi, his way of negotiating life, in order to be enabled. This is the tip of the iceberg. There is much more to be discovered and mined, both in terms of intertextual allusion and the connections. There are wonderful things here. One of the things that I'll end in a minute and leave some time for questions or comments, but in chapter 31, in that encounter the night before with Lavan, it says that Lavan accuses him of running away, and he says, "I worked faithfully for you, and if were it not for God who protected me, lulei Hashem, right? Yigia kapai ra'a, God saw the toil of my hand." And the words that are used are yigia kapai, the toil of my hand, ra'a, he saw. And think about it, in the next chapter, in chapter 32, Vayar ki lo yacholo vayiga bekaf yirecho. God saw, not God, the angel, the wrestling figure saw that he cannot overcome him, and he touched his thigh. The same words, he saw, he touched the socket. Okay, touched the socket. He saw and he touched the socket of his thigh. Means has no connection in the English language to God saw the toil of my hand. But in Hebrew, yigia kapai ra'a and vayar vayiga bakaf are the same words. I want to encourage all of you to, who haven't begun to look at the text in this way and look at wordplay as very serious, as an intertextual allusion that connects texts, that connect words like gedi and gid and lahagid, to begin to entertain this. Now, the Midrash developed this, but it developed it in a very impressionistic way. A few broad brush strokes about plays on words that have been dismissed throughout the ages as a separate category, and I'm suggesting that there is a level of pshat reading, a level of tight, close literary reading that also, if it's mindful enough of wordplay, of phonetics, you can begin to see texts conversing with one another, and particularly you can see the text conversing with a subtext in much the same way that the conscious points to the unconscious or the subconscious. You've been very patient. Now I'll give you a chance to talk or to ask or to comment, and we've got just a few minutes. Please. I do want to say again that the limited number, you can if you're interested in reading more about this, you can get the book on through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and I have not at the bookstore, but on their website. But the title of the book is Wrestling Jacob, Deception, Identity, and Freudian Slips in Genesis, and I have 20 or so copies here that I would be happy to sell afterwards. Please.
Okay. It doesn't seem to me that Jacob acted solely on his own, because I do assume that the parents were co-conspirator in giving him the blessing. First of all, Rivka preferred him over the firstborn. And I can't believe that Isaac was so tam that he can't even tell the difference between venison and the ghee that he was eating. And I thought he really knew that he was giving the blessing to Jacob and not to Esav. So there are co-conspirators in starting this whole drama.
As well, if it was such an enabling moment, then you would have assumed that this would have had an impact on his family going forward. And if you continue with the stories, the deception, continue with the Chamor, where they kill all the natives of that village, it continues with the sons of Yaakov, with him being deceived in the future by them not telling him that Yosef was killed. It just continues on and on and on. So how cathartic was the moment? What to what degree did it have an impact on future generations?
Just a sort of quick comment about this idea of working through. At the end, let's say, when we see that the perhaps scene of completion, let's say, when Yaakov actually receives the sort of validation of his self and leads to the panim, you know, sort of modality of his identity. Is it not, in a sense, perhaps an extension of your of what you were saying before, of this idea of repetition that is implicitly dual for the rest of the Torah? I mean, Yisrael implicitly becomes the name for community as well as for an individual, in the sense that his autonomous identity is always kind of split between representing a community but also being a proper name, which in a way preserves, like what Freud said, you know, psychoanalysis in a sense doesn't cure, it helps us work through. So the sort of preservation of the conflict, which I think maybe corroborates what you're working with. So.
One or two more really quickly, so I'll have time to respond at least to one or two.
You may have mentioned this already, but what about the use of the word halak to describe Yaakov?
Okay. You know, I probably should cut it off at this. One more question, yes. Or comment.
Yes, I wonder what impact you feel it should have on us in terms of did we really steal the birthright today?
Okay, that's a interesting one. Look, I want to tell you two things. I think I only have time to relate to two of the questions, but in terms of the parents as co-conspirators, in the early chapters, I thought I could initially write this book about Yaakov, and I realized early on that if I want to understand Yaakov, I have to understand Yitzchak. If I understand Yitzchak, I have to understand the Akedah. And in the Akedah, this is a class that I gave at Or Chaim over Shabbat, my sense is that the tzayid, the venison, it's not that he loves barbecue, Isaac. It is that the tzayid is most likely the ayil. That's what they hunted. They hunted deer. And that the ayil represents, if Isaac lives with an abiding sense of that traumatic moment, he doesn't return. He's not described as returning from the Akedah. Abraham returns from the mountain. Isaac is not described as returning. He is psychically, not physically, but still there. And so he cannot, he's not described as loving his own children. He's got that moment of the slaughtering knife of his father over his own head. And when he wants to love his own children, one, he can't love at all. And the other, he can only love when he brings him the smell of a burnt deer to his nostrils, in the celebrated passage of Proust, brings back to him the moment of relief of the Akedah. So I think I have theories that I've developed here. You can take them and leave them, but I do agree that in terms of the parents and their role in this and Rivka's role in this, it needs a lot of analysis, some of which I've done in the book. And in terms of how cathartic, I would just maybe end the session I have 5 minutes. Great. I want to just a brief quote. I don't quote in the book a great deal of psychotherapy or psychology, but when I reached that point of describing of Larry your question about to what extent is it cathartic, and he continues to be called Yaakov as well as Israel, and he the very next day, by the way, he says to his brother, "I'll meet you on Har Seir," which is very pregnant with because Seir is also the hairiness that he impersonated by putting the gidi. And here in Lahagid, he can't even say, "We're going to go our separate ways." He says, "I'll meet up with you later," and he never does. He goes the other direction. He evades. He escapes. It's the retreat from or the need for further struggle with his own Yaakov, with his own inner Yaakov, continues, and it's evident already the next day. But when I was trying to convince readers that Batuchal should be you have been enabled, as opposed to you have prevailed or emerged victorious, I did quote two psychotherapists, and I want to quote David Shapiro, who I mentioned before, who wrote the following. We introduce a patient about the psychotherapeutic moment, about the cathartic breakthrough. He writes, we introduce a patient to himself. We see a change in him. He feels a change in himself. Yet a week or two later, he may talk about the same thing in much the same way he did originally, as if the new awareness has left him. Why should the same territory have to be won again and again? Self-awareness, once achieved, we have thought, deprives those restrictive dynamics, i.e., I translate that as the sense of being possessed rather than possessing, the sense of constricted autonomy. We thought that the self-awareness deprived those dynamics, those mechanisms, of their automatic engagement and their force. When we intervene and articulate what the patient cannot spontaneously articulate, when we act in that way to enlarge self-awareness, we penetrate the otherwise reflexively triggered limits of the restrictive system, and in doing so, we theoretically disable it. I like this quote because it had the word disable in there, too. And indeed, it seems we do, momentarily, yet not a week later. I think this is a real description, and when I see both the ultimate, we ourselves as B'nai Yisrael, I want to suggest to you that in some very deep level, Sefer Breshit and much of Tanakh is really not about external struggle. It's not about the struggle between nations or between brothers or between parents and children. It is about inner struggle. It's about becoming whole. When he emerges from this place, his next destination is Salem. But Salem in Hebrew is Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Okay? He came Shalem, whole. But whole or integrated, as opposed to disintegrated, okay, does not mean perfect. It does not mean that the battle has been won. The battle is ongoing. And that's why B'nai Yisrael are called after this verse, Ki sarita im Elokim v'im anashim v'tuchal, because you're struggling. The essence of our identity is not victory, it is struggle. And the struggle is ongoing. That's the good news and the bad news. Thank you very much.